you will start by staying in bed. Being awake is the first and hardest thing to get through, and you may ache every minute of the hours in between the relief of sleep. The ache will overwhelm you at times. The ache will press on your chest so hard it might be difficult to move. The ache will shake through your body in uncontrollable sobs. The ache will numb you to all feeling. The ache will want to break things. The ache won't care what does break. Try to wait.
Welcome to From Here With a View, a We Are the Seeds Philadelphia podcast. My name is Tylin Ogoyo, and I will be your host today. Today, we have the great honor of talking with Krista Couture, who is an award-winning performing and recording artist, filmmaker, nonfiction writer, and broadcaster. Krista describes herself as proudly Indigenous, mixed Cree and Scandinavian, queer, disabled, and a mom. Her seventh album, Safe Harbor, was released on Koch Records in 2020. As a writer and storyteller, she has been published in Room, Shameless, and Auger magazines, and on cbc.ca. In 2018, her CBC article on photos on disability and pregnancy went viral. Couture is a frequent contributor to CBC Radio and former weekday afternoon host on 106.5 Element FM in Toronto. Her debut memoir, How to Lose Everything, is out now with Douglas and McIntyre. Krista is currently producing a series of short animated films that will premiere on CBC Gem in the fall of 2022. Welcome, Krista. Thank you so, so much for being here with me today.
Thank you.
We just watched the trailer for How to Lose Everything, A Field Guide, which I'd like to just jump in and talk about how this short film came to be.
Yeah. So when I was writing my memoir, How to Lose Everything, for a long time, I hadn't even started it because I wasn't sure how it was going to end. You know, it's my lived experience. It's my stories. And I knew what pieces would go in there. But I was like, but where does the book land? How will this book, this piece, this story come to a close? And then one day, this passage, the field guide, kind of came out of me just in one of those moments of inspiration and flow. I wrote this. It's kind of almost an epilogue. It's in the second person and it's addressing the reader really directly. And as I wrote it, I just could see it animated in my mind. I thought this, I would love to see this with images. And so that was just kind of percolating in my thoughts somewhere. And then while I was working actually at Element FM, my colleague, Bob McGee, shared a video like on our Facebook page for work that his daughter had animated, Becky O'Neill. And as soon as I saw that piece, I was like, that's what I want. I saw her work and I was like, that's what I've been imagining. This is the person I want to do it with. And then the dots just started connecting. We applied for a grant. We got some grant money to make the thing. And her work, her style was just the perfect fit. So she co-directed it with me and it came into life.
Thank you for that. It's so beautiful. And it's something that I feel is so important to put out in the world. And I remember you talking about in one of your performances, like these types of things have touched everybody in some way. And so the idea that something from your heart, that it being visual and narrated, creating this emotion for the viewer, but also giving some sort of beautiful resolve, I think it's just something that you don't see very often. You hear a lot about a lot of people feeling very stuck or guilty. And the point where you say, like, go easy on yourself. I don't know the exact words that you say, but give yourself space. Did you feel like in writing that part of the book and actually doing this animation, did you feel like you were putting healing energies out into the world, or were you just, you know, like working on your project and damn, but didn't quite think about how it would ripple out into the world?
That's interesting. I think, it's true. Everyone is touched by grief. Everyone experiences grief. It's so universal. And yet we feel often very alone in it and very isolated. And there's ways that grief is also so specific and so personal, right? And so those things are true at the same time. And certainly culturally in our Western culture, we don't talk about it enough, and there isn't a welcoming space for it enough, sort of broadly speaking. You know, it's kind of good vibes only, and you don't want to be a downer, and we're all, you know, doing better and getting better all the time. And so when you're grieving or you're feeling sorrow, like sometimes that's kind of counter to this kind of larger expectation. So when I wrote that passage, I wanted to both feel less alone and offer to others that they aren't alone, which maybe is a way of saying of creating something healing. I wanted to share from my experience things that I have learned that have been helpful, like the insights that I've gained through my losses, as a way of saying, like if you're there, if you're in that rough terrain of grief and you feel like you can't see the edges of it and you don't know how to get out, like, that's okay. Like, I've been there. You're not alone. And this is how I describe, you know, what I saw when I was there. And so I hope that it's healing. I hope that it connects for people. I mean, the whole book, you know, the field guide kind of was like this culmination, because it, in a way, it was sort of also satisfying the title of the book and the film of How to Lose Everything, because in the moment that finally I'm like, and this is how you get through it, I guess is what I mean when I say how to lose everything. Like, here's an example of how to get through it. But I talk about grief and I share my stories because I want to both, you know, offer an invitation into some of my more extraordinary experiences that people are curious about. You know, my left leg was amputated above the knee when I was 13. I had bone cancer. My first son died as a newborn. My second son died at 14 months old. And sometimes people hear these sort of bullet point losses of mine and they're like, whoa, I don't know about those things. And so in a way, the film and the book was to kind of answer that and tell those stories in the way that I want to. And then also the kind of secondary message of the book and the film was like, and whatever your loss is, whatever your heartbreak is, it doesn't have to be the same as mine. We have something in common.
Right. Wow. That's powerful stuff. I'd like to ask you about, you do so many things. You work in so many mediums, music, broadcasting, filmmaking, but you started singing when you were very young. You mentioned that you wanted to open up your life to people because people ask. And so when you started making music, at what point was it when people started being very intrigued by you and asking these types of questions? And what kind of process was that for you to say, okay, I'm fine with sharing it. And actually, I think it's helpful to share, because not everybody would be open to doing that.
Yeah. And we all have our own like line where that is. I think sometimes people kind of receive me as like, I'm a just big wide open book, and I'm not. I definitely have limits of what I don't share, but it has been a learning. It's just that mine might be a little bigger than some other people's. But I've learned and I've kind of practiced and tested those limits over time and largely through my music. And so, you know, I was a singer-songwriter first for many years. And my music is also very autobiographical and draws on my own experiences and was telling a lot of these same stories, but in a way that's maybe not as explicit, or, you know, because a song is 3 minutes long, there's a chorus, it all rhymes, you know, there's poetic license. And so maybe people hear the songs and think, is that true? Is that about her? Like, I could sort of hide or protect myself in the songs, but I was still sharing my heartbreak. I was still sharing my losses. I was still sharing what I was trying to learn and figure out and understand. And something that was very powerful about doing that through music was that, especially when I was touring, you know, I'd be singing those same songs every night, you know, pretty much. It's like the same 12 songs every night before a different audience. And so in getting to tell the stories kind of in a way over and over really helped me integrate and get used to how much I wanted to share, because I was kind of practicing it repeatedly and kind of developing the stories that I wanted to tell. And early on, like I think with my first album in particular, the first time I was doing like interviews and media and I was, you know, 22 and I overshared. I said way more than I, you know, later felt comfortable with. So some of it was just over time and through experience of like, oh, that's more than I wanted to say. Okay, that felt like too much. So now I'm going to try this. And so it was kind of a lot of trial and error, but always wanting to still communicate through the songs or now through, you know, more recently the book and the film, like genuinely and openly, like I do want to share, you know, there's meant to be some vulnerability in it, but it is a vulnerability that I am very clear on for myself, you know?
Right. That's exactly what I was thinking when you were saying in early interviews that now it's on your own terms.
Yeah.
Where I could see other interviews or, you know, people trying to extract some information for you to exploit it or to create a story that they want to twist around and sell whatever they need to sell.
Totally.
And by you taking ownership of your own story and creating this gorgeous book and these beautiful films, then you have complete agency over what's out in the world. And that's so incredibly profound. And for all those listening, if you look up Krista and go on Krista's website and look at all these videos, you'll see just how you emanate this incredible peace and confidence. And really this, it's very soothing actually to watch and to hear you talk to your audiences, because it's like, you know, obviously you're human and you go through all the emotions like we all do, but when you gather yourself and you're so present, it's just very powerful to see how you arrive and how you share mm-hmm. yourself. And it's beautiful. And as an artist myself, I just think like to have found the place to where you have boundaries for it, but also to be able to give is such a fine, delicate balance. And you so have nailed that. So congratulations on that.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'm glad that that's how that comes across.
it's all really beautiful. When did you start writing the book, How to Lose Everything?
I'd written a couple of the chapters in 2016. I was pregnant with my daughter, Sona, who's now almost 5. And again, the idea had been kind of percolating, and I was waiting for the ending. And actually, in a way, being pregnant with my daughter also gave me an ending, because it was such a signpost of how much had changed, you know, to be at a point where I, you know, tried to get pregnant, got pregnant, and, you know, she was coming. That was like such a point where I could look back at it all, that these experiences and stories were in the past. They were no longer like actively happening. And so I started to write it during the pregnancy, and then I finished it in the first year of her life. I, you know, it's incredible. Like, what, you know, people say, if you want something done, ask a busy person. And so I had a couple hours Tuesday morning and a couple hours Wednesday afternoon to write. And so over kind of 7-8 months, I wrote my book in those little pockets of time when I had some childcare and got it done. But I was just motivated, sat down and had a plan. And then it was published in 2020.
And since then, you've been on this journey with these beautiful films. Can you describe for the audiences who haven't had a chance to see the video, what the kind of energy is and the vibe of these animations? Because they're very unique.
For Field Guide? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the short film, How to Lose Everything, a Field Guide, is primarily animated in watercolor paintings. And so Becky O'Neill and her partner Keith Del Principe did over 3,000 watercolor images that, you know, paint it, you take a picture, you paint it, you take a picture, and you end up with a 4-minute animation. And then there's a little bit of like what's called in-camera animation at the beginning with some physical objects. And I mean, animation felt so perfect for this story because it's so laborious. Like, grief is slow and it changes shape and it comes and it goes and it takes a long time. And so animation, because it's it's so slow, and it's frame by frame. It's one step and then the next step. It felt like such a fit for the theme to have to really piece something together. And so there are these beautiful images. A lot of the inks that Becky uses are from like plant-based inks that are from Ontario, like where we are. She has a farm not far from Toronto that she's on. And so she uses a lot of inks made from local plants and flowers. And so it's also kind of imbued with the place where she was creating it. And so there are these very soft images with these beautiful earthy colors.
Thank you for sharing that. I would love to talk about all the mediums that you work in, as we mentioned before, music, broadcasting, filmmaking, and all have writing as a common denominator. Do you find one more satisfying than the other? Are you able to choose? Is it different times in your life that you find one more satisfying?
Yeah, I think this is something I'm like still figuring out. So this answer will be me processing. I'm like, what is it about these different things and which one comes to the foreground? I mean, it was music for so long. And my traditional name is Sanibe, which means singing woman. And that was always, I mean, the teaching was I will sing a lot and I will talk a lot. That's what my parents were told in my naming ceremony. And so I grew up knowing that I'm singing woman and that's what I do and that's who I am in the world. And so when I stopped making music and kind of stepping back and taking a break from that, I actually struggled. I struggled with, but like, how can I be singing woman if I'm not, like, that's what I'm supposed to do. Even though someone was like, just go get a new name. I was like, oh, okay, phew, maybe that's the solution. But I started to think more of it around storytelling. I was like, well, maybe as singing woman, what I do is tell stories and it could be a kind of broader interpretation of song. And it just kind of, it shifted pretty organically. Like the book idea came in and then the film idea kind of landed into place. And I feel like I've just been connecting the dots and kind of following the dots a little bit and trying to just trust what I'm being drawn to. It feels strange that I'm not making music in the way that I used to, because it was so like the focus of all my choices for a long time. You know, as an artist, right? You like everything can kind of support the art, right? Like your other jobs that you take or where you live or, you know, choices for your family. It's like, how do I fit in my art with all this other stuff? And so it was singing for so long, but I don't quite miss it yet. And I don't know what that means. And so I don't know if it's coming back or if that was then. So it's just that right now writing and the filmmaking just happens to be what's in front of me and what I'm drawn to. So I guess it's what I'm most enjoying right now.
I actually completely understand what you're talking about, because I'm going through the same process with acting. I recently told my agent here that I need to take a break just because of capacity, but I'm really enjoying not pursuing it, you know, and not having to think about that piece. But then I'm thinking, well, will that come back or am I done? Or, you know, but it's like life just goes through its phases and you just never know. And I love what you said about just honoring it and trusting it and knowing that wherever you take your life, it's where it's meant to go. I mean, you didn't say that exactly.
No, but I think that's well said. I think that's well said, but it's hard, right? Like, I don't know if you feel this, like it's also kind of an ego, like it's such a big part of my identity, right? Mm-hmm. Like being a performer was such a big part of my identity. So to stop, I don't know if you feel this with acting, it's like, well, then what is something else taking place? Or is that part just not like, of course, we all have all many identities, right? And so I'm like, is it just not there anymore? I don't know.
that there's that, but there's also, but this was supposed to be my favorite thing in the world. How come I'm not doing it?
This was your passion, right?
Right. Yeah. But then you find other favorite things in the world. So, that's exciting and beautiful. And I'm glad we just had this conversation, because it just occurred to me that that's a positive thing and not a negative thing. Right.
It
means that there are so many other beautiful things happening that.
Yeah. That other things are growing
for, right. To grow. Mm-hmm. And And that doesn't mean it won't come back.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to talk about your unique perspective and your unique experiences. And do you think that the youth that look at the work that you're doing and follow you, if there are spaces in their life that your life experiences resonate with them, do you think it's helpful to them to have that kind of representation?
Yeah, I was just thinking the word representation. I think to me, representation is so powerful. I have experienced that, in my identities, when I finally find and see people who share some of my social location. And it's part of why I make these parts of myself visible, you know, the ways that I make my disability visible, the ways I talk about being queer, my indigeneity, being a mom, the losses I've experienced, grief. Like, I make it visible for myself, but again, also kind of as an offering, because I know how meaningful it can be to find someone who you're like, oh, that's me too, you know? And particularly now that I'm, you know, not that there's like the other side of these experiences, grief will always be part of my path, but I'm in a place where I can talk about this stuff that feels like empowered and that I feel good in. You know, it took me a long time to feel good in my disabled body. It took me a long time to be comfortable being visible. I felt like crap about it for a long time, right? Which makes sense. There's so all sorts of things around us to tell us to feel like crap, all of us. And so it's hard won, and I'm proud to share where I'm at. And if that helps anybody else, great. Because I've been helped by other people sharing their stories and by other queer people and other Indigenous women and other disabled people, or maybe all three at once, like me, like who I've gone, oh, phew, you're amazing, or like, you seem okay, like you're thriving, or like you're sharing how you're struggling. Like, all of those things are really impactful. And I just think our little human selves, we so deeply want to be seen and heard. And so representation is part of that, even if it's not a personal connection with someone, the way we see someone on social media, or other media, it's like to feel seen and heard through representation, I think, is incredibly important.
Totally agree with that it is so important. And even if it's not completely obvious, even if it's in the background, right? Yeah, we need to find people that we can resonate with. I have a question, and I know you've answered this so many times and you've talked about it so many times. So if you don't want to talk about it, that's okay.
No, bring it.
But I want to talk about your gorgeous leg and how you've made the fabric with the lamination. And I've heard you say this, but I would love if you would give more specifics, because you're like, well, it wasn't that hard to put together. Just got some, but it looks so, it's just so beautiful. So the leg that you have is a new addition of technology. Can you explain that a bit? And then we'll go step by step into how it's become just high fashion.
Yes. And I love talking about my prosthetic leg. So the knee that I have, though I sort of more largely refer to it as the leg, but really it's the knee component that I got now almost 8 years ago. It's called a microprocessor knee. And so it has a little microprocessor in there like that takes 90 readings per second. And so every time I swing the leg through, it's taking in all this information about where it is in space, how much energy I've put into it. And that helps the speed of the swing. It helps how it lands. If it's bent, if it's like, oh, the knee is bent and you're putting weight on me, it provides resistance. And so if I'm going downstairs, it will provide resistance. Or if I'm on a hill, or if I'm falling, it will catch me. And every knee that I had before this microprocessor one did not have that. It was just like a little, I mean, still incredible technology that people figured out hydraulics and things. Still cool. But before, the knees I had, they had to be always completely straight and the knee had to be locked. And if the knee wasn't locked, I would just fall because it had no resistance. And it just had one speed and it couldn't interpret really kind of the input. And so the microprocessor, it's so cool, and it changed my life. It changed how I walk. It changed, I feel safer when I walk. I feel you know, just better in my body. And it comes down to just the fact that I fall less often. That's actually it. I used to fall a couple times a week, and I, you know, knock on wood, I have maybe a fall every 6 months, and that is simple and it's life-changing. It's really nice to not fall. And so the microprocessor knee, where I lived in Vancouver at the time, but in Canada, our provincial healthcare doesn't cover these kinds of knees. And so a friend of mine had started a fundraising, like a crowd, you know, funding campaign at the time. We called it the Knee Raiser, and raised the, it was $25,000 towards buying this knee, because they're incredible, but they're really expensive. And so they're not very accessible. They're not really accessible at all, because who has that? But this incredible fundraiser that, you know, I sometimes call it the knee that folk music bought, because it felt like my entire music community like stepped up and contributed. And it was some artist being like, here's $20, which I just was like, I know that that's all you've got. Like, that's amazing. Thank you. And then like an uncle who could throw in $2,000 or whatever. So it's like all of those pieces came together. And so the knee, not only like physically, mechanically improved my life, the experience of getting the knee, I felt so cared for. It just was like everyone stepped forward to get me this thing. And so it was also just an experience of feeling really loved, which was part of what led to decorating it. Because I got this incredible knee and I was like, how do I celebrate? How do I express gratitude for this thing that I'm just going to wear pants and no one will know I'm this like superhero who had this whole community rally for? And I had seen, and now I'm just like, I'm taking the next step now, Tyler, and I'm moving ahead in the story, but I had seen this person on Instagram with a floral leg. So the word is cosmesis, like the cosmetic cover for a prosthetic is a cosmesis. And it, the one I saw was like hand-painted. It was stunning. It's this, they're called the Alternative Limb Project. They're based in the UK. And I saw it and I was like, oh, I could make it pretty. Like it could be, it could, it doesn't have to feel just like medical or like a fake leg or be skin colored, which is not a thing. It could just look like a work of art. It doesn't have to try and look like a quote unquote real leg. And it had never occurred to me to decorate it. And so I took the photo to my prosthetic clinic and was like, how do we do this? Like, what's the affordable version of this incredibly hand-painted leg? And they were like, well, you can just pick a fabric. And so this part is accessible. Any fabric you find, like people can choose whatever print or color they like. And then it's laminated onto the fiberglass shell. And so that part of the process is very simple, but the effect is so cool. And the fabric that I chose is this like linen upholstery fabric. It looks very vintagey. And so the flowers, people often think it's hand painted. It has a kind of, you know, looks like an illustration. And it turned out so beautifully. And it was the impact on me was more than I could have imagined, because it became, like you said, it's my favorite accessory now. I love to joke that it goes with everything. And people look at me and appreciate this thing about me, versus it was this thing that I used to hide and was like, didn't want people to know. Like, I don't want people to know I only have one leg. What will they say? What will they ask? And now I'm like, look at my leg. This is a thing about me that is, you know, not completely uncommon. There's plenty of amputees, but I'm often the first amputee someone has met. And so it's this thing about me that's unusual, and it can be something that can be celebrated. Our differences can be celebrated, and there can be ways that we can elevate them, and that we can be, you know, excited about what makes each other different. You know, it doesn't have to be like, oh, that happened to you. Oh my God, I'm so sorry. You know, I can be like, wow, that's so interesting, you know? So that's the story of the leg.
Thank you so much for doing that again.
I'm so happy to. I love it. It's a good story.
I just could visualize it when you were talking about it. It is absolutely beautiful. And it is, I can see how it can shift, not just it, how it is visually, but what you're talking about, that the crowdfunding and community came together, and artists, you know, $20 is a lot, and people came together because they wanted to support and lift you. And it's obvious how you carry yourself and walk in the world, that it's just like this powerful magic that you have with you all the time. It's really wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that. Very excited for the projects coming up and to see where your life will take you next. It seems like there may be things down the road that you haven't even thought of yet. Can you share with us where people can find your music, your film, and your book?
Yes. So, I mean, my music is on all the things, yeah. Spotify and Apple Music. It's Krista Couture. And my website is KristaCouture.com. I'm on Instagram at KristaCouture. And so my book, same. It's in your local library. It's in your bookstore. It's on Amazon. And the film, which is now the first of five short films, will be released in Canada, we think in November on CBC Gem. I don't know yet how they're going to be available outside of Canada, but if people find me on Instagram, hopefully I'll be spreading the word as to how people can see the film and the other films once they're available.
That is fantastic. Thank you so much for joining me here on From Here With A View today. It's been wonderful having a chat with you.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. You've been listening to From Here With A View. We are the Seeds Philadelphia podcast. I'm your host, Tylan Ogoyo. We'll see you next time. From Here With A View, or We Are The Seeds Philadelphia podcast, is produced by Michelle St. John with music by Zachariah Julian and original logo art by Jason Wiesaw. This podcast is funded in part by Independence Public Media Foundation.